So let's turn to where we left off in Berlin-Alexanderplatz, which was around 216, the beginning of the fifth book. And I went through and picked out a few that I really think we should do, but recognizing that I need to do as quickly as I can. And I thought I'd warm up by going through another one of these city scenes, because, again, these are the things that fascinate me the most, just getting that feel and seeing how a modernist artist was able to capture what it was like to be in the city and combining sounds and sights and smells and giving you this cubist stream of consciousness sense of the totality. So let's just start by going through that on page 216. Boom, boom. The steam pile driver thumps in front of Aschinger's on the Alex. It's one story high and knocks the rails into the ground as if they were nothing at all. Now, seems like, you know, maybe just a sort of strange detail, but as the rest of the story is going on, this pile driver is pounding away. So you have this industrial engine grinding away all the time. And when you're when you're reading some of these thoughts or even conversations, occasionally you get boom, boom in that. And so what Dublin is telling you is this construction is going all the time in the neighborhood where these things are taking place. And that darned pile driver is pounding away in the background. So he's giving you that feel for that and mixing that in. Here in description, but often it's just thrown in there in conversations and so forth. So this also, of course, the violence of it, the sense of the pounding, bam, brutal quality, that brutal sound is running behind all of this. And, for instance, Fassbinder doesn't have going on in his background all the time. You can't capture that. Icy air, February. People walk in overcoats. Whoever has a fur piece wears it. Whoever hasn't doesn't wear it. The men have on thin stockings and are freezing, of course, but they look nice. The bums have disappeared with the cold. When it gets warmer, they'll stick their noses out again. In the meantime, they nip a double ration of brandy, but don't ask me what it's like. Nobody would want to swim in it, not even a corpse. Boom, boom, the steel pile driver batters away on the Alex. A lot of people have time to spare and watch the pile driver whacking away. Up on top, there's a man who is always pulling on a chain. Then there's a puff on top, and bang, the rod gets it in the neck. So there's that violent language. You know, it's not just the sound that's going on there, but it's a symbol for that violence. Something pounding away at everybody, and everybody's mind, and everybody's soul in this environment. There they stand, men and women, especially youngsters. They love the way it works, as if it were greased. Bang, the rod gets it in the neck. After that, it grows small as the tip of your finger. But it gets another blow, and it's welcomed now to do whatever it pleases. Finally, it's gone, so the pile's driven into the ground. Hell's bells, they've given it a nice drubbing. The people walk away satisfied. Right? So there's that sense of, I mean, he's building in that sense, you're watching a pile get driven into the ground, and people get a satisfaction out of seeing that violence, seeing that pressure on that object. Okay, so then I thought we should move ahead to page 221. The latter mostly holding women's hands. To enumerate them all and to describe their destinies is hardly possible. But you see, the modernist cubist author would like to do that, wants to give you a feeling for everything that's going on. That's why you're getting these asides. And that's fascinating. I mean, it's Apollinaire, it's Joyce, it's John Dos Passos doing similar things, Gertrude Stein, strategies for telling you, you know, there isn't just this one little story here. I'm trying to give you a vision or a feel for everything that's going on, and I would like to enumerate all the stories of these people, right? Though I can't. So it's a remarkable effort, I would say. And only in a few cases would this succeed. The wind scatters chafe over all of them alike. The faces of the eastward wanderers are in no way different from those of the wanderers to the west, south, and north. Moreover, they exchange their roles. Those who are now crossing the square towards Aschinger's may be seen an hour later in front of the empty Hahn department store. So here's this movement of those crowds, as the movie tried to capture with those shots of people coming to and fro businesses or crossing streets and so on. You know, really the Impressionists were trying to capture this too, this transition, this constant change going on in the city. Just as those who come from Brunnenstraße on their way to Janowitzbrücke mingle with those coming from the reverse direction. Yes, and many of them turn off from the side, from south to east, from south to west, from north to west, from north to east. So it's this disorienting, uncoordinated process going on in the city. This is the urban landscape. It's not just Franz's story we're trying to get a feel for, but it's this awareness of modernity that comes to fruition in the Weimar era. People like Gosch and Brecht and Weil and Otto Dix and Döblin trying to capture that, celebrate it, but also show its, you know, its dark and tough aspects as well. Right? All those expressionist films, gangster films, so on. Right? This is this urban world, and part a great part of this modernist style is to capture that. And it's not all, let's just celebrate it because it's wonderful to be free and we love all this confusion. Obviously, Franz is confused and disoriented and it's devastating and he's lost and he's alienated, right? So Döblin isn't what the right makes him out to be, this Jewish supporter of this urban asphalt culture is what they call it. Right? He's pointing out its realities. Whereas they will look at that and say, this is what we're against. Even though they're still going to be modern, they're still going to have cities and so on and so forth, they give the impression that they're going to bring back a kind of traditionalism, help save people like Franz from this world of crowds and disorientation and feeling alone and feeling alienated, right? But it's important to feel that. They have the same equanimity as the passengers in an omnibus or in streetcars. The latter all sit in different postures, making the weight of the car, as indicated outside, heavier still. Who could find out what is happening inside them? A tremendous chapter. And if anyone did write it, whose advantage would it be? Okay, so he would like to write that story, even better than he has here. And I, for one, want to hear it, and that is an important part of this Weimar culture. Okay, 222, so next page. See if you could find that. The pile driver thumps down. Boom, that thing's still going. I beat everything. Another rail. Beating things. Boom, that viciousness is there. Then back to Franz. Bottom two. Next paragraph. Franz Bieberkopf has his knapsack on again and is selling newspapers. Okay, so he's coming back after the... I'm not focusing so much on the story, but he's coming back after this terrible drinking bout that he went into after looters had screwed him and messed up his relationship with the widow and so forth. He has changed his beat. He has left the Rosenthaler Tor, is now on the Alexanderplatz. He is feeling entirely okay again. 5 feet, 10.5 inches tall, his weight is down, that makes it easier to carry. On his head he wears the official newspaper cap. Skipping a little bit, he has the stand at Alexanderstrasse's subway exit, opposite the Ufa movie house. If we found photographs of Alexanderplatz, we could probably see exactly where Döblin is describing. Right? We would know there's a U-Bahn F exit there, and there's a movie house, and we can assume this is pretty accurate. Bieberkopf looks down Mundstrasse as he stands for the first time in a crowd and thinks to himself, "Wonder how far it is to the two Jews. They don't live far from here." That was when I was having my first troubles. Maybe I'll call on one of them these days. Okay? So, there's that. He does have this relationship with these two Jews, and we talked a little bit about last time, although I can't quite crack what Döblin is doing with it. But interestingly here, they might buy a copy of the Völkischer Beobachter from me. Why not, if they want it? I don't care, as long as they buy it. Now, that's a funny aside. Does anybody recognize what newspaper that is? Whose newspaper is that? Völkischer Beobachter. That's the Nazi paper, right? So, and this shows how dim Franz is, right? I think, right? Or, you know, just maybe just the sort of blasé attitude of the times. But anyway, you know, his notion is that he could sell a couple of papers of anti-Semitic party par excellence to these Jews, right? Okay. And then even that paper, though, we get a sense of what the headlines are. Talk of a crisis in Reichstag. Number 17, Hebelstrasse evacuated owing to danger of collapse. Murder on a fishing boat. Mutineer or a madman. So some of the headlines, some of the stories that are going on, even in that paper. Just for those who like a little bit more specific historical data, on 2/26, I noted we got a date. We're in 1928 here. So in the golden years, 27, 28, up till the fall in 1929. Right. So we have February 9, 1928. Labor government fell in Oslo, newspaper headlines. And it was the last night of the six-day bicycle races in Stuttgart. We had some images of those six-day bicycle races. Okay. So skimming ahead, a couple storylines on around on out on the My 235 under spirited white slavery. 140. He's meeting Reinhold. Okay, this vicious guy who's going to play an important role as things go on. And then moving ahead four or five pages, around the time, well, the closest paragraph start is Reinhold looked at him, the bottom of page 239. We have a page for that? 142. 142. Just above that, Reinhold and Franz work out this chain business with women, where Reinhold will have a girlfriend and he'll pass that girlfriend on to Franz and so forth. Right. So that's this reference to white slavery. Again, that's just the storyline. Then on moving ahead to page, I'm going to go to page 252 under local news. So move ahead about 10 pages. It's clunky, I know. But.
150.
Okay, 150. Thank you. She's the quickest. It was the second week in April, and when the weather in Berlin is sometimes spring-like, and as the press unanimously stated, this splendid Easter weather lured people out of doors. In Berlin at that time, Alex Frankel, a Russian student, shot and killed Vera Kaminskaya, age 22, arts and crafts worker in their boarding house. Tatiana Samftleben, same age, a governess who had agreed to join in the suicide pact, became afraid of this decision at the last moment and ran away when she saw her girlfriend lying on the floor. She met a squad of police to whom she told the story of her terrible experience of the last few months and led the officers to the place where Vera and Alex were lying mortally wounded. The criminal police were called in, and the homicide commission dispatched its officers to the spot. Alex and Vera had planned to get married, but economic conditions did not permit their conjugal union. So, one of these blips here, these stories that are going on in the background, along with stock rates, which follow a little bit further down here, other stories of particular individuals, but the double suicide by young couples, you know, hopelessly despairing because economic conditions wouldn't allow them to get married. Right. So, that tension of the Weimar culture on people, driving them to suicide and crime and murder and so on. Okay, 259. So ahead to the, under the title, Franz has made a devastating resolution. Okay, and then two more pages beyond that. Again, more following the storyline. Reinhold, he thinks he can control Reinhold. He knows Reinhold's dangerous and violent, but he thinks he can manage him. And this is, again, this ongoing sense of two major themes. First, Franz wants order. He thinks he can impose some sort of order on his environment, his friends, as well as himself, and the situation. He just thinks he can do it as an individual. He's a big, powerful guy, and he, at least in the images that Fassbinder has given us, big guy, and he's been in the war, and he just thinks he can control things. Meck ought to just watch him, admire him, how he, Franz, can bring a fellow like Reinhold to his senses, and how he makes him turn about face, and he's got to get used to law and order, and we'll swing it, all right? Okay. So his desire for law and order and his confidence that he can do it himself. Right? That runs through. Many times we have passages where he communicates that. And essentially, I would say that's what that Dublin is arguing is impossible in these circumstances. He's just he's fated by these external forces to fail. I don't think I need that. Page 262. So two pages beyond that, above the paragraph starting, and what does Truda say? Okay.
156.
Okay, so above that paragraph, what do you say, Mick? We'll create law and order in this world. We'll smash this thing. Let them come if they want anything out of us. Franz pummels Reinhold's shoulder. It twitches. You see, old boy, you got to get a hold of yourself. Then everything will go right in this world of ours. That's what I always say. A fellow's got to get hold of himself and stick it out and let them come on. So there's that confidence, that sense that the individual can prevail. And in political terms, this is liberalism. Right? This is a celebration of the liberal individual who should be able to make it in a free market economy, we'll say. Right? So I guess Dublin really is, I mean, I'm pushing a little bit further, but here's the individual trying to make it, trying to do things legitimately, trying to find jobs. Right. He's been a criminal, yes, he's tainted, but he's trying to do it. And this is the fate. And Dublin's really saying that in this economy, just stripping it down to that, it's not working. It's not working. Now, we could push it to Germany is tainted. Germany fought the First World War. Right? It's had its criminal, violent background. Germany's trying to make it as a liberal society with free market and so on. But all this criminality, this corruption, and fundamentally the economy is just propped up on loans, let's say, from the United States, so it's artificial, it's destined to fail. Yeah, you have to think about whether it's legitimate to push it that far. But anyway, somewhere in between, I would say, is legitimate. Okay, 274. Okay, so where were we? I lost what page were we on? Okay, moving on. I skipped my pages there. This has me all confused now. I'm trying to figure out how to move you through that. Okay, we are on 263, so about 10 pages ahead. And see if you can find... They had reached Alexanderplatz, 274.
63.
Okay. There they saw a crowd gathered, and they went near it. So more of this crowd scenes on Alexanderplatz. They were right in the midst of the crowd. It was a common brawl. So we had that shot in Berlin of a Symphony of a Big City, people pushing around, people arguing, two men arguing, the cops coming in, breaking it up. So here's an environment like that. Franz looked around for the little man. He was gone, vanished, right? Losing somebody in the crowd. He stepped into a little cafe, took a kümmel, probably a bun of some sort, roll. Thumbed the pages of the Vorwärts, that's the socialist paper, and the Lokale Anzeige, not sure. Not much more in them than the Morgenpost. There's a big horse race in England and Paris, too. They probably had to shell out a lot of dough for that. So you're getting your average reader of the newspapers, looks through newspapers of different political persuasion, doesn't seem to latch on to any of their ideology, just sort of these detailed sports events, statistics, and so on. He's about to go home and make a right about face, but he can't help crossing the street to see what's happening in the crowd. Right, so here's the individual moving around in these masses. Try our buck sausage with salad. Here you are, young man, the great and only buck sausage. So you're getting some of the street advertising. Montag morgen, die Welt on Montag, all these newspapers. And I think you could probably say, for us, all of these newspapers indicate this incredible diversity of political opinions out there that are the manifestation of a parliamentary system, representational, straight proportional representation. Every political persuasion has its own newspaper, right? So you're getting bombarded with all these options. How are you going to pick when you have so many to choose from? I think it's a shame that we have so few to choose from in the United States, right? But still, one of the problems with Weimar society was the splintering of the political system. And in some ways, the newspapers themselves embody that. And you can see how he's sort of He's just numb to them as he moves around. Okay. Look at those two guys. They've been at each other for a half an hour now, beating the stuffing out of each other and for no reason at all. So here's that basic, brutal violence on the street. Right? Street fights going on, not even with any political significance. They're fighting for no reason at all. Say, I'm going to stick around here till tomorrow. Hey, maybe you'd subscribe to a standing room ticket. You need a lot of them, don't you? So just sitting there in the street, hanging out, watching what's going on, that's a form of entertainment, you know, for people who have nothing else to do. That's the other subtext here. All these guys are wandering around. They don't have jobs. Right? It's the unemployment is the cause of most of these situations. Because they're all sort of looking around, figuring out what kind of angle they can find. Right? Buying and selling stuff with each other, and there's no real progression going on. When Franz has pushed his way through the crowd till he gets up to the front, who do you think is fighting there with whom? Two lads, he knows them, they're Pum's boys, so one of the gangs that he's been involved with in the past. Okay, so more fighting. Boy, did you let that fellow kick you around like that? Why, you're no good. What's this? Pushing around here. Hey, there. Oh, baby, the cops, the bulls. Chase, cheese it, the cops, beat it. Okay, so that whole scene is sort of plays itself out in the film and obviously was very much part of the street life in Alexanderplatz at the time. Now, he hooks up with these guys, ends up involved with this burglary. He's the watchman. He doesn't really know what's going on. He's uncomfortable with the whole thing once he starts to figure it out. And now, okay, page 283 is where I was going to start here. The light goes out. Franz stumbles back. Can we find that? Eight pages forward? 168. Franz stumbles back. Something is trembling in him. He gulps. What's this all about anyway? Where are those guys? So he's starting to figure out what's happening. He is back in front of the big door when two of them come from the rear. Murder, thief, they're pinching things. They're breaking into this place. I want to get away from here. Oh, for an ice pond, a sliding board, and away we go on the chute to the chutes, over the water and back to Alexanderplatz. But they hold him back. Reinhold among them, he's got an iron claw. Didn't they tell you nothing? You stand here and keep an eye out if there's any trouble. Okay? So he's being forced to follow through on this. This burglary, which he really didn't know what was going on. So this is that criminality pulling him back. Right? What options does he really have? He keeps pulling back into this. Page and a half over. Above, I'd like to get away from here. And I'm starting just above that. The world is made of iron. You can't do anything about it. It comes rushing up at you like a steamroller. Nothing to be done about it. There it comes. It rushes on. There they sit on the inside. That's a tank. Inside a devil with horns and flaming eyes. They tear your flesh to pieces. And it rushes on and nobody can escape. Now it twitches in the dark. When light comes, we'll be able to see it all. How it lies there. What it was like. So this just the sense of disorienting, lack of control. The individual is just at the mercy of these forces. I'd like to get away from here. I'd like to get away. Those crooks, the dirty hounds, I don't want anything like that. Right? So this is this whole notion. He wants to do it well, legally, but he's not able to do it. And, you know, before I can't speak to this from experience. But as I read through this, of course, the circumstances are different. It's not Germany. It's not in the 20s. But This something similar has to be at work in the tough neighborhoods of just about any city, and I would think of a young black kid in a tough neighborhood. Right? How do you get out? How does somebody stay legal? You know, stay in school when all those forces are at work on them. Of course, that's what I can only know from reading and from observation of imagery in the media, which is all kind of slanted and so on. But I would think there is this sense for many of them that they're just fated to be sucked into this petty criminal lifestyle. And even their best efforts are thwarted at every step to break out of that. There are just so many peer pressures as well as economic pressures that they must feel the same kind of resignation that ultimately Franz is here. So if you're trying to get a hook into this, I would think that that might be the way to make it more contemporary for you. Okay, so then on 280, bottom of 287 for me, at that moment, Reinhold, a couple pages ahead. 172. At that moment, Reinhold gives a secret signal to the man opposite him. Darkness and light alternate in the car. There's a hunt on. Unperceived, Reinhold has slipped his hand to the latch on the door just beside Franz. They are racing into a wide thoroughfare. Franz is still looking back. All of a sudden, someone grabs him by the chest and wrenches him forward. He tries to get up, strikes Reinhold in the face, but the latter is terribly strong. The wind roars into the car. Snow comes flying in. Franz is thrust across the bundles, across the open door. With a yell, he grabs Reinhold around the neck. At that moment, someone at his side strikes his arm with a stick. The second man in the car gives him a jerk and a whack on his left thigh, and as he rolls down off the bundles of clothing, Franz is poked through the open door. He tries to catch hold with his legs wherever he can. His arms cling to the running board. Then a stick comes crashing down on the back of his head. Crouching over him, Reinhold throws his body out into the street. The door slams to. The pursuing car races over the man. Hunters and hunted vanish into the blizzard. Okay. So, Reinhold and this gang have, I guess they sense that he's a potential canary. Reinhold sometimes is nice to him and sometimes is cruel. They throw him into the car and he's run over by the following car. So they try to kill him. Then, you know, pop into, I can't tell you if this is going through his brain or what Jobelin is doing exactly, but he goes into this sort of astronomical sight. Let us be happy when the sun rises and its beautiful light is here. Gas light might go out, electric light too. People get up when the alarm clock rattles. If it was April 8th yesterday, it is the 9th today. If it was Sunday, it's now Monday. The year has not changed, nor the month, but a change has occurred nevertheless. The world has rolled ahead. Astronomers concern themselves a great deal with this body, the sun. According to them, it is the central body of our planetary system. For our Earth is only a small planet, and what indeed are we? When the sun rises like that and we are glad, we should really be sad, for what are we anyway? The sun is 300,000 times greater than the Earth, and what a host of numbers and zeros there still are. And all they have to say is this: we are but a zero, nothing at all, just nothing. Simply ridiculous, isn't it, to be happy over that? So a very existentialist kind of aside there. The minuscule significance of our existence, of Franz's fate, and so on, in the face of all of this, but also this sort of bleak pessimism. That particular line reminds me of a line being written at about the same time by Hemingway: "Ar nada, who art in nada, nada be thy nada." He just inverts the Lord's Prayer and just says there's nothing. Okay, 294, so sixth book, under the first heading, Ill-Gotten Gain Thrives, and the next page or so, 294. He's involved with a woman named Trude here, Reinhold is, and we just get an example of how vicious Reinhold is. So here's that violence that comes out, that consistent brutality. And again, we may be pushing it to a certain degree with a lot of this, but in general we do see this brutalization of life in the streets of Weimar, in the culture of Weimar, and tend to want to trace it to the experience of the First World War, and ultimately manifesting itself in the brutality of the politics, and the cheapness of life. When we hear about political murder, let's say within the Nazi Party, the Night of the Long Knives in 1934. Or the rounding up of opponents in that 1933-1934, SPD, KPD, putting them into concentration camps. The first concentration camps were actually the basements of their bars. the earliest photographs of communists being rounded up and beaten and tortured were there. You can see they're in the basements of whatever their local hangouts were. Then they went out to Dachau and got that land and put together that concentration. But the first places they were taking them were just in the bar. So it comes out of the street fighting. And for that reason, it's just to give you a feel. You know, it wasn't like everything was hunky-dory. None of this happened. And suddenly this Nazis come into power and wham, you know, it's just vicious, brutal SS cruelty. It merges out of this environment. They're products of this environment. They're part of it. And the capacity to serve on these execution squads, for instance, in the East, and just, you know, line people up and shoot them in the back of the neck. It's not, they're not just being dropped into that. It's a tough world that they're coming out of, and that they're part of. This isn't in any way a way to just an effort to justify it, but to contextualize it historically. Right? Life was less valuable coming out of the First World War. So many had died then. I just watched the other night, it goes with the territory, and I should have seen it before, but Sophie Scholl. and that's beautiful. And I would like, really, there are a number of movies I'd love to show you, but that's, it's intense. Exposition of the bravery of a young woman and her brother your age. And it's very powerful. And the last scene is devastating, where they run them into the execution room and they just slide them up on this guillotine and that's it. And then you just hear the brother come in and then the friend come in. And, you know, it's just horrifying. Because you've identified with Sophie Scholl and her brother so intensively through the film. And again, this is not an effort to explain it or justify it, but you have to realize that hundreds of thousands of soldiers were fighting and dying on the Eastern Front from the perspective of the regime and so on. So what's three students? That's nothing. Right? Their lives were literally nothing to them. And so we look back and see that their lives were full, and we have that feeling for them, that compassion. But at the time, they were just three shirkers, right? And of course, they were made examples of in an intensive way. But when, you know, 300,000 soldiers have just been lost at Stalingrad, the loss of three soldiers or three students who'd thrown leaflets out was meaningless, right? So it's part of that, and in the long haul, you can see that the First World War had reduced things to that level, to a great part, and the war had never really ended in Germany. The First World War never really ended because of the terms, because they had lost, and the long-term effects of it on everybody, especially symbolically. So here's Reinhold giving Trude a frightful beating, tearing out her hair and breaking a mirror overhead. He could do everything. All this, as I said, Reinhold was able to do because a couple of glasses of booze had narcotized his forebrain, whereupon his middle brain got a free hand. It was, on the whole, more efficient anyway. Remember, Dublin's a doctor who's practiced psychology or psychiatry. So that's where you get all those sort of medical asides. The mirror was smashed, and somebody had vulgarly been spitting on the floor, and it was blood at that. Reinhold inspected the wreckage around him. His own mouth was intact, so it must have been Trude who had spat, and he had smashed up her beezer. This put him in such high spirits and self-esteem that he laughed aloud. So just that toughness. And, of course, Reinhold's part of the story, so just to put that in there, this guy's dangerous. Now, in 299, for story's sake, Bibikov loses his arm. His arm was run over by the car. He wasn't killed. A private car had picked him up, and that night Franz was operated on. His right arm was sawn off at the shoulder joint. So now he's physically damaged. So 307, and giving the page thing, I try to keep these little ones to a minimum, but this effort to stay decent. That was so eight pages or so ahead. He cannot speak but thinks to himself, "Yes, I wanted to stay decent. I did stay decent till the end." And he's visiting some old friends who are part of his criminal background. "So you mustn't get offended that I didn't come around. You remain my friends. I didn't betray any of you." He lies mute. They go out. But again, this desire on his part to stay decent, that's consistent. Okay, let's move ahead to 321. He's not recovering. He's still down and out after this. "Arise, weak spirit, and get on your feet," is the subtitle.
190.
"There are states of swoon which amount to death in the living body. Franz Bibikov, still unconscious, is put back to bed. He keeps on lying there on into the warm days and reaches this conclusion. I'm at death's door. I feel it. I'm going to croak. If you don't do something now, Franz, something real, final, comprehensive, if you don't take a club in your hand, a saber, and beat around you, if you don't run loose no matter how, Franz, little Bibikov, old horse, then it's all over with you for sure. Then you can have your measure taken for a coffin." So, from his perspective, what's necessary is action and violent action. He's got to lash out. He's got to fight. He's got to fight somehow to recover and get some sort of balance. And then again, page 322, "Life is a hellish thing, isn't it? You knew it once before, that time in Henschke's saloon when they wanted to kick you out with your armband, and that fellow attacked you, and you hadn't done anything to him. And I thought that the world was peaceful, that there was law and order, but there's something out of order. There they are, and how terrible they seem now." Okay, that was in a moment of clairvoyance. He saw that things weren't as orderly as he hoped. So again, just more of that. But it's such an important theme, and it's remarkable that Devlin keeps hammering away at it. And in the end, I'll come around to the way I would approach that. Okay. Let's move ahead a little bit. Okay, here's a real extreme example of this brutalization of popular culture and mentality. Page 342, and so that's about 15 pages ahead, 20 pages ahead. 342. "Two men are sitting in Rosenthaler Straße."
203?
"At noon, ladling out pea soup. One has the Berliner Zeitung beside him." Okay. Another newspaper. "He laughs. Fearful domestic tragedy in Western Germany." He laughs. "What do you mean? What's that to laugh at? Listen to this. A father throws his three children into the water. Three at one stroke. Rambunctious fellow, all right. Where did it happen? Ham, in Westphalia. That's some mess. Boy, he must have had it full up to here. But you can depend on a fellow like him, all right. Wait a minute. Let's see what he did with the wife. Must have given her... Nope, she did it on her own. Did it beforehand. What you say to that? Gay little family that, Max. They know how to live. Letter from wife. Deceiver. With an exclamation point. He ought to hear that. As I am tired of leading this life, I've decided to jump into the canal. Get yourself a rope and hang yourself. Julia. Full stop." He doubles up with laughter. "Not much harmony in that family. The canal for her and the rope for him. The wife says hang yourself, and he throws the children into the water. The man didn't listen to her. Nothing could come from a marriage like that." So just this callousness. If we take Devlin at his word, right, this is, again, tough circumstances. Okay, so for story purposes, on around 351, so about five or so pages after this, Franz meets Mise through Reinhold, right, I believe. And then they develop a relationship to the point where on 357, which starts slowly, slowly, something begins to dawn on Franz. 357. Slowly, slowly, it's about six pages ahead.
212.
So that's the way things are. She's, quote, seeing other men, I would say. She noticed that he's beginning to understand. Well, of course, and what of it? She wants to earn money. And ain't she, isn't she right? I earn my money too. So she's prostituting herself, right, and getting money for the two of them, right, for him. And he doesn't like that, but, you know, that's the way it is, right? I earn my money too. It doesn't suit her to let you support her, all the more since you can't quite do it with your arm. That's so. She told me right away. Didn't bat an eye. You bet, that's a fine girl. You can depend on her, all right. You must take care of yourself, she says, after all the trouble you had this year. And before that, too, dearie, things didn't go too well for you out there in Tegel. You know what I mean? She'd be ashamed to let you sweat and drudge like that. So she works for you. Only she don't dare say anything to you about it. Right? And, you know, obviously we've had other images of prostitution and so on, but here, you know, we get a sense of why somebody's doing it to help out this guy. But it's very symbolic of the decadence and the kind of decline that took place in Berlin, the openness of sexuality, but also the economics of it. I think I mentioned it last time, but women were alone. That's part of the reason it was okay for women to walk in the streets openly, because so many men had died in the war. There are just a lot of women who are alone. And I just, as an aside, when I was living in Germany when I was your age, it's probably less evident now, but 20 years ago, 20 some years ago, right? A very, very common experience anywhere you went, especially as a tourist, was to see groups of 60 to 70 year old women, whole busloads of them. And you would notice it as a tourist because they all wore basically the same dress. They had the same, it was the same cut dress, different colors, same cut dress from the 40s or maybe the 50s is the way they looked. And, but they were just huge groups of women, and they were at all the tourist sites because, you know, they were still going to those traditional things that young hip people wouldn't be that interested in, right? And these were war widows from the Second World War. Women who had lost their husbands in the Second World War, just whole groups of them. You saw them around all the time. Now you probably won't see them anymore, but it's just sort of the equivalent. I mean, the war had its impact on women's lives in that regard. They were on their own. Not all forced into prostitution, but that becomes symbolic of that influence. Okay. Now, under defensive war against bourgeois society, that's the subtitle. And starting on page 363, is where I'll start. For those of you who have been looking for some more hard political data, we get a sequence here where Franz is involved with and hearing some political discourse from the period. He's at a rally, or some sort of meeting is going on in the background, and he's listening to a speech, and then he's involved with a political conversation with what's his name? Willie. With Willie. And it's what you're getting here is the anarchist view. Somebody said that, right? We're getting anarchism. But also, from that position, you know, a strong critique of the other parties that are active at the time. So it gives us a good sense, some sense of that. The German Reich is a republic, and whoever doesn't believe it gets one in the neck. Right, so there's that violence, sort of a satirical statement on the part of whomever. I'm not sure whose voice that is. It sounds almost like de Blin's himself, but it's supposed to be a Republican peaceful state, but whoever doesn't believe it gets one in the neck. Right. So then we get this speech. And when you get down to it, we're not here to talk into thin air. Let's leave that to the fellows in the Reichstag. Someone once asked one of our comrades if he wouldn't like to get into the Reichstag. So this is an anarchist. Into the Reichstag with its golden cupola overhead and club chairs below. Says he, you know, comrade, if I was to do that and go into the Reichstag, I'd just be one more scoundrel. We got no time to talk through our hats, comrades. No phony stuff for us. So, this real apathy, to say the least, about the political culture of the day, about what's going on in the Reichstag. You know, they're just scoundrels, and it's just a talk shop. The communists that say, in all sincerity, we're out to pursue a policy of exposure. We've seen what comes out of that. The communists got corrupted themselves. And we need waste no words on their policy of exposure. It's all a big swindle. Even a blind man can see all there is to expose in Germany. And for that, we don't have to go to the Reichstag. But a man who can't see that, why, there's nothing to be done for him, with or without the Reichstag. That hot air shop is good for nothing except to soft soap the people, and all the parties know it, except the so-called representatives of the working classes. Okay. So, I mean, it seems like things have changed a little bit in our world, that young people are actually saying, well, maybe we can make a difference, and they're getting on, you know, one of these campaigns, and there's a little change going on. But I think over the last 8 to maybe 16 years, there's been a sense that, you know, it's all corrupt. So I think you know what they're talking about to a certain degree, that sense of disaffection with corrupt politicians. Can we make any difference at all? The companies seem to be running everything. Well, here we get from Döblin that Germans felt about like that. Right? And it's not coming from a Nazi, but it's coming from an anarchist, someone on the far left. So I think that's interesting, because he isn't trying to give us the Nazi perspective, but this is the kind of thing that the Nazis were saying too, right? That the Reichstag is just a big hot air shop full of corruption, right? It's just baloney. And they do get in there and they do disrupt it, because they don't have any respect for what's going on there. They just saw it as a mess. Our pious socialists. Well, we already see religious socialists in the party, and that's the last straw. They've all got to get religion, so let them run after the priests. So maybe that would be the equivalent for some of us who are more secular humanist oriented or whatever. It's a little bit disconcerting to hear these Democrats playing the religious card. You know, whatever it takes to get that southern vote or whatever, right? So here he's saying the socialists, they're supposed to be, you know, secular, non-religious, and if they're selling out to religion as well, I mean, that's just a sign of their willingness to say and do anything to collect it and keep their power. So some of the same attitudes that some of you may be familiar with, directed toward the parliamentary system. The socialists want nothing, know nothing, can do nothing. They always have a majority in the Reichstag, but they don't know what to do with it. Very common attitude toward socialists, right? They did have the majority for the most part, but always having themselves to work with other parties in order to bring anything about, constantly having to put together coalitions, never really able to promote the socialist program, at least as it theoretically would be. A lot of infighting within them, between revisionists and revolutionaries and so on and so forth. That's just the more extreme example. So a sense of dismay over their inability to really put forth some sort of policies that would make change, bring about change. So moving over a page or so, 366, under comrades. Parliamentarism prolongs the misery of the workers. They might talk of a crisis of justice, and indeed justice ought to be reformed lock, stock, and barrel. The juridical body should be renewed. It should be made republican, constitutional, just. But we don't want new judges. We want instead this justice, no justice at all. We must overthrow all state institutions by direct action. That's the anarchist voice. Right? But what's important here is that general sense that the judicial system was completely screwed up as well. And that's important in general, because what happens with the far right is that it's treated with kid gloves by the justice system, because you have a lot of judges who are left over from the pre-war era. They're not replaced with the revolution. They're still there. They're still there with the attitudes, and they're vicious versus leftists who appear in front of them. But right wingers like Adolf Hitler, who should have been immediately expelled from the country, or even put up for treason after the Beer Hall Putsch, was given a light sentence because the judge just happened to be a conservative. Right? So, the justice system wasn't in any way in sync with the supposed progressive aspect of the Weimar political system. So, there's more there. Let's go to page 273. So, this is after, the closest paragraph started is, the worker gulps down his seltzer water. 222. Okay, just above that, Franz's voice again. A man's got only himself, just himself. I looked after myself. I'm a self-provider, I am. And this is sort of that street liberalism. Right? Street free marketism. I should be able to do this myself as an individual if I could. Right? The worker gulps down his seltzer water and nods. Well, then try it alone. Franz laughs and laughs. The worker. And I've told you that three dozen times already, you can't do anything alone. We need a fighting organization. We've got to bring enlightenment to the masses to cope with the despotic rule of the state and the economic monopoly. Franz laughs and laughs. No higher being will save mankind. No Kaiser, People's Tribune, God can rescue us from misery's grind. Alone, we have to bear the rod. So there's his individualistic, you know, I have to fight my fate or I'll die trying. And the old socialist is saying, you've got to have a fighting organization. You have to unite with others. So there's a sort of idealistic leftist prescription for the problem. They sit opposite each other, silent now. The old worker in the green collar stares at Franz, who looks him hard in the eyes. What you looking at, boy? You can't get me, eh? The worker opens his mouth. I tell you, I can see, comrade. I'm wasting my breath on you. You're thick-skulled. You're butt your head against the wall. You don't know what the main thing for the proletariat is, solidarity. That you don't know. So this older voice of the socialist left is saying, look, we have to unite against this. In the end, I think that is Dublin's message, if a clear one can be drawn. And here it's coming from the voice of this this old, wizened left-wing worker. Okay, there's some straight politics, and now let's go to just 391, and this is okay. So that was 373, so about 20 pages ahead. Little gap, and then now in that place there's a mountain, and the old man arises and said to his son.
232.
Okay, 232. I'm not going to go through it, but I just want to point out Dublin's inserting dreams. Dreams are showing up explicitly. So Freudian aspect is there. He is a psychiatrist and so on, and so you get these dream sequences included as well. Very much part of the modernist style to capture that. So let's move from that. Another 10 pages or so to page 402. With underneath the subtitle, Forward in Step, Role of Drums and Battalions. Okay. Look out, old man. When the shells fall, there'll be dirt flying around. Forward, step high, straight on through. I gotta get out. Forward. All they can do is smash my bones. Drum, drum, drum. In step, one, two, one, two. Left, right, left, right, left, right. Franz Bieberkopf marches through the streets with a firm step. So here, you know, as he's trying to pull himself out again, the military background. He was at the front, right? So that kind of language. Franz Bieberkopf marches through the streets with a firm step. Left, right, don't pretend to be tired. No saloons, no boozing now, we'll see about it. One ball winged by death came flying. That's what we'd like to see if it's sent for me. I'm down, left, right, roll of drums and battalions. At last he breathes easy. Marching through Berlin, when the soldiers go marching along through town, oh why, just why, that's why, just because of tarara, 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 boom die. The houses stand still, the wind blows where it will, oh why, that's why, just because of tarara, tarara, boom die. So some sort of song going through his head. So that military background hums into his brain every once in a while as well. Few subtle signs that he's a former soldier. He doesn't make a big deal of that, and I think I, as a historian, I would have made a bigger deal of that if I were writing the book. Right? More anti-Semitism and more the fact that he is a soldier. But Stubblin's subtle. He weaves those things in more subtly than I would. And that may be an indication that my perception is skewed because I'm looking for those things, right? Seeing it through the lens of National Socialism. He just sees them as part of an otherwise complicated personality and doesn't give them extra weight, but they're present. I'll spare you more depression, but on between 422 and 424, right above the duel starts, it's a rainy day, it's rainy weather, that the two pages before that is just a depiction of a suicidally depressed young woman, another one of the pictures here. Okay, now for story purposes, around page 440, and so that's about 15 pages ahead. And in general, what's happening during this section, starting around for 2 days, Franz Bieberkopf says nothing after a gap. A little louder?
261.
Okay, what's happening here is that he and he's falling in love with Mieskin, with Mise. Okay, so, you know, does have this heart that reveals itself every once in a while. For whom have I kept my heart pure? For whom, sure, for you alone, tonight will my happiness come near. Boldly I'll call to you, my dear, for you, I swear, I'll always pine. Tonight I'm yours and you are mine. These are probably songs. If we knew pop culture in Weimar era, we would know what those were. Mieskin, my darling Mieskin, you look like a little bride made of marzipan. Mieskin, what is it, Franz? Well, nothing. I just about ya. I just glad about ya. Franz, how can one look at ya? How can she say a fellow's name? I'm just happy, that's all. So he's happy, temporarily, that he is falling in love with Mieskin at some level. But this violence is always part of it. 462, we see Franz beating Mieskin. So despite his feelings, about 20 pages ahead, I've started, Franz shakes her, bellowing. 462. Franz shakes her, bellowing. 274. What you want anyway? Let me go now. What am I going to do with the bitch? But here I'm here, friends. Can I ain't run away from you. I'm still here. Beat it. I don't want you around. Don't holler at me. My God, what have I done? Go ahead and stay with him if you love him, you bitch. I ain't a bitch. Be nice, Franzkin. Right. Dot, 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 dot. He gets his arm free and he breaks loose. She runs after him. Franz turns around at once and strikes her in the face so that she reels back. He pummels her shoulder and she falls. He's over her now, hitting her with one hand wherever he can. She sits there, her blouse all torn, one eye shut, with blood streaming from her nose, smearing her left cheek and chin. Mies' mouth is wide open. Earthquakes, lightning, thunder, the tracks are rent asunder. Twisted, the stations, smoke signal, in ruins. There's a roaring, rolling, fuming, smoking, clouds, nothing to be seen. Everything gone, gone, blown away, vertically, horizontally. Right? The whole scene is just spinning, the violence, the sadness of it all. Now, besides this being an indication of Franz's violence and inability to control himself and anger and so forth, for the storyline, what's important is that Reinhold's present for all of this. He knows about Mise, and he's seen Franz beat her, and he's actually going to use that information ultimately for his own ends to really cause Franz more pain in his viciousness. And that, I'll move ahead to that. Starting about 477, Mise has gone with Reinhold out into the woods, taken a drive, and so there's a gap there. But in the woods, Mise and Reinhold are walking alone.
Okay.
So we have starting there, their interactions, their walking, and so on, and then starting at 483, so about six pages ahead, he crushes her to his breast. This is under there, lying on a slope in a grassy hollow. So we are here, fine, here's the girl, everything's Jake, a fine kid, a humdinger. I'll keep her a long time and Franz can beef as much as he likes. So he's just being cruel to Franz. He won't get her back so soon as all of that. Reinhold slides downwards, pulling Misa along, pressing her into his arms and kissing her mouth. He sucks himself in, not a thought in his head, only an ecstasy, a wild desire, pure savagery, and that's all there is to it. Every gesture is prescribed. Let none come near to impede him now. A renting, a tearing, which no hurricane, no avalanche of rocks can hinder. It is a shell from a cannon, a mine exploded. All that rushes against it is shattered, thrust aside, and on it goes, on and on. So he's just this bestial, violent, you know, character. And he's, she's obviously in danger. And page 487, so about four pages ahead there, he walks behind her. Little line there. 487. Needn't brag about your friends, even if you're his whore. I'm going home now. What do you mean, going home? Got a screw loose or something? Maybe you don't know who you're talking to. You can talk that way to poor old nut of yours, but not to me. Oh, I don't know what to do. Go back to the hollow like a good girl. And then you get, you know, sort of the significance of all those slaughter scenes that he's put in before. When a little calf is to be slaughtered, they tie a rope around its neck and lead it to the bench. Then they lift the little calf, put it on a bench, and tie it firmly. Right? So, you know, he uses that imagery to sort of set up the horror that's going to happen on the next page. Murder, help, Franz, Franzkin. And then instead of giving you a, you know, real direct description, it's a season, to everything it's season, a time to strangle, a time to heal, to break down and to build up, to rent and to sow, to everything it's season. She throws herself down trying to escape. They wrestle in the hollow. Help, Franz! We'll pull that job all right. We'll play a little joke on your Franz. They don't have something to talk about the whole week. I want to go home. Try and do it. Many a one has tried. He kneels on her back. His hands are around her throat. His thumb's on the nape of her neck. Her body contracts, contracts. Her body contracts. There's a season to be born and to die. To be born and to die. To everything it's season. So, a modernist description of the murder. Biblical references, obviously. Two pages over now. Now it starts. Boom. Zoom. Without fife or drum. The trees sway left and right. Boom. Zoom. Boom. But they cannot keep in time. Just when the trees bend towards the left, boom, it goes to the left again, and they snap and crack, grate and grind, burst, crackle, and thud down. So this whole image of, you know, just swirling, the whole situation is out of control, lost its balance, right, whatever you can draw from this. Boom, there it is back again. Look out. Boom, zoom, zoom. Those are bombs from airplanes. It wants to tear the wood down, to crush the whole wood. The trees howl and rock, and there's a crackle. They break. There's a little rattle. Boom. Life's at stake. Boom, zoom. The sun is gone. Tottering waits. Night. Boom, zoom. I'm yourn, come now, we'll soon be there. I'm yourn, boom, zoom. Right, so those are probably song titles, description of the trees blowing in the strong stormy wind, this boom, zoom business. There's a lot going on there in a modernist, cryptic, cubist, futurist way, just to give you that feeling of that the center can't hold, things are falling apart, all the things that Yeats communicated and will be communicated, let's say, Grosch's dedicated to Oskar Panizza. You know, this blood-red tide has been unleashed. That's, I think, more or less what Dublin is communicating with reference to Mises' murder. Okay. Try to move things to, I mean, okay, Franz doesn't know about this, right? He doesn't know what's happened, and just to carry the storyline along here, He only finds out about it on page 533. And how does he find out about it? In the newspaper. So 533. I'm skipping ahead 30 pages. Franz looks at her, his big eyes staring at her. And that's about 2 pages behind, back from Behold the Tears of Such as Were Oppressed. That's the subtitle.
316.
Okay. So 316, Franz looks at her, his big eyes staring at her. He holds the paper in the flat of his hand. His head is shaking. He reads and babbles and jerks, stumbling, crackling. Right. Murder in Freienwalde. Emily Pasunka of Bernau, that's in Poland, born June 12, 1908. It's Misa, Eva. He scratches his cheek, looks at Eva with a vague, empty, hollow look. One can't see down into it. It's Misa, Eva. Yes? What do you say, Eva? She's dead. That's why we didn't find her. And you're in the papers, Franz. Me? He takes the paper again and looks at it. It's my picture. Okay, so he's been accused of it. But here's that impact of sort of mass communications in the newspaper that he discovers that this has happened. So, I mean, I don't know if we can make the equivalent, but the newspaper serves the same function as text messaging and the computer and the web does for you. You know, you're getting these things from that source. And that's how exciting it was. So it really become this massive thing, and it was coming at you from everywhere, and they had the same feeling you probably do, just being inundated with information, both personal and impersonal, coming all the time. Okay, so he's accused, and I'm going to move ahead toward the end now, but he's on the run, and then ultimately he's going to be arrested, and that takes place in you have the guideline there, but it takes place about page 569 for those in my book, but that's not so important. Let's move ahead to his visions in the asylum. Starting about 596. So, let's see, where does that break? Where's a good break to help you with? Can you find grape sugar and camphor syringes? That's a subtext that's on page 594. It's into the ninth book. 351. So go ahead about five. He's in the hospital, fights with the doctors under that page. Then about 5 pages ahead, he goes into another dream sequence. 596. Franz Bieberkopf is now unconscious and drifting in space. 354. Okay. So just before that, in the paragraph above that, he mentions Freud directly. But then we get a whole sequence where Franz's soul has reached a deep stratum and consciousness is present at only in intervals. Right, so he's just floating through all of this stuff. And I won't go through all of the stuff that he floats through, but eventually he's going to be visited by all the major characters. They're going to flit through his brain. And again, this is more for its modernist stylistic value. Starting on 609. And you can find this. After now Franz hears death's slow song. So you have Dublin capturing, you know, the dream life of this character that he's been following. Ludas comes on 609. He's a miserable cuss, such a funny little man. He walks upstairs peddling shoelaces. So the impact of the past on his subconscious. Reinhold comes on 610. Ugh, the bastard. So here you are. What do you want? Do you want to play the big gazook with me? No rain will ever wash you clean, you crook, you murderer, you big scoundrel. Right. So he tears into Reinhold's. Ida shows up. That's the woman he first killed and put him in jail before our book, 613. Thank God, Ida, you've come. Okay. Misa shows up, then up on page 615. Misa comes to France. Her face is very quiet, calm, and gentle. So, this whole sequence of his past. And then on page 616, now we must depict what pain is. On the last page of that section. With a deep shudder, he greets the specter of that wretched Luders. Evil Reinhold sloshes up to him. With a deep shudder, he encounters Ida's voice, Mies's face. It is she. Everything is fulfilled. Franz weeps and weeps. I'm guilty. So he takes the blame for all of this. I am not a human being. I'm just a beast, a monster. Thus died, in that evening hour, Franz Bibikov, erstwhile transport worker, burglar, pimp, murderer. Another man lay in the bed, and that other one has the same papers as Franz. He looks like Franz, but in another world he bears a new name. This, then, has been the fall of Franz Bibikov, which I have tried to describe, beginning with Franz's discharge from Tegel prison up to his end in the Buch Insane Asylum during the winter of 1928-1929. Now I will append a report about the first hours and days of a new man having the same identity papers as he. So the implication here is that Dublin's taken you up to this ultimate crisis, the complete breakdown. Now we've had previous breakdowns where Franz has been just completely out of it and drinking and so on, but he's literally gone mad, right, and been in the asylum and completely blotted out. And what he's saying is that this whole experience through age 28-29 leading up to this full breakdown symbolizes the death of that old Franz Bibikov. The slug who tried to make it on his own is dead. Okay? And a new man is being created. And that your ears have to prick up. What is Dublin trying to say about a new man? There's a lot of talk about the new man in Weimar political culture and German political culture after the turn of the century. We had Nietzschean versions of that, and you have leftist versions of that, and you have right-wing versions of that, you have militarized versions of that. So now we have to listen. What is it that Dublin means when he says there's a new figure evolving here, and that this whole story has been really designed in order to communicate that, to tell us about that story. Okay? So, the next section is very cryptic. You have the whore of Babylon struggling with death. And it's sort of a poetic dreams-like scape, which includes images of the French revolutionary armies, Napoleon's armies, marching into Russia, the legions march along the Beresina, icy cold and icy wind. They have crossed from France and the great Napoleon leads them, roaring wind, flurries of snow, bullets whine, they fight on the ice, they charge and fall. Always that cry, long live the emperor, long live the emperor. The sacrifice, and that is death. So death is present there, in that major effort. Rolling of railroads, thunder of guns, bursting hand grenades, curtain fire, chemin des dames, Langemark, dear fatherland, be comfort thine, be comfort thine. Shattered dugouts, fallen soldiers, death folds his cloak, singing, oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. So the First World War, right? The First World War is just death has been victorious over that. Marching, marching, we went to war with iron tread, 100 minstrels march ahead. Red of morning, red of night, shines on us death's early lights, or a song, death, death. It's along with all of this marching, death folds his cloak and sings, oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. Here's a very weird passage. A lot of people have tried to tackle this one. An oven burns, before an oven stands a mother with 7 sons, and the groaning of a people is behind them. Quietly radiant, there they stand. Will you deny and submit? Okay. And the first son says no and suffered tortures. And all 7 sons say no and suffers tortures. And then the mother stands there, says no and suffers tortures. Death folds his cloak and sings, oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. I mean, very haunting when you think of the Holocaust to come, but this is written before that, so just this very bleak vision of what history is leading toward. Death is consuming all of these things. the great effort of the French Revolution, the great efforts of the First World War, and then that sort of terrifying vision of the future. Cries and rejoicings. On they march, sixes, by twos and by threes. The French Revolution marches on. The Russian Revolution marches on. The Peasants' Wars march on. The Anabaptists all march behind death. And they rejoice behind him. Onward to freedom. To freedom they go. The old world must fall. Awake, O morning. Now Babylon the Great can at last pull her beast up onto its legs. It starts trotting, races across the fields, sinks down in the snow. She turns around, howls at the gleaming figure of death. At her outcry, the beast falls on its knees, and the woman sways over the neck of the beast. Death draws his cloak around him. He sings and beams. Oh yes, oh yes. The field murmurs. Oh yes. Well, what to make of all of that, right? I admit it's challenging. And what I'm going to do is, I wrote down my reflections on that. So I've tried to do this all without reading notes, but I have to just sort of turn to this for a second and tell you what I think. What I draw from this is that the French Revolutionary and the Russian Revolutionary, and then references to the Peasant Wars, which are also there, were all organized revolutions that were very destructive. They all ended up marching behind death. Now, this seems negative and contradictory to any sense of socialist optimism. But the point here is that Franz's old spirit is dying. Right, so that's it's sort of like a summary of all of these efforts. All of these efforts are in the past, and that something new is necessary. Taken together, that the fact that Franz's spirit has died, this could mean that all revolution leads to death of an earlier version of man in hope of fabricating a new one. He's been critical of the Socialist Party all the way through this. This hasn't been a straight party line. It's an idealized kind of socialism that he's presenting here. Something beyond what's been achieved before is necessary. Something cleaner, something more abstract. So it's going to be different from what the parties and these previous efforts, French Revolution, Russian Revolution, have attempted. In the crisis, he seeks some reason to assume that progress will result from these horrors. German society is going to die as Franz did. So this Weimar culture, it's going to die. It's dying. And in fact, I'm not sure when he's finishing this, but he's describing 1928, 1929. It is dying. This is the last year of the Weimar Republic as really before the real collapse takes place. Right? So he is describing the death knell of the Weimar Republic. What's going to reemerge? Is it going to be a new man, new society? Right? Is it going to be a purer, more honest, less selfish form? Franz is good, but he's selfish in the sense that he's always thinking about how he can achieve things on his own, and that what's necessary is a group of individuals who are willing to work for a greater good and really do that, not become corrupted like the socialist parties before them. That's the source of the pessimism, of the destructiveness. Now, what's tricky here for us is that the Nazis were basically arguing the same sort of thing, that you need to have a community, a Gemeinschaft, and not just a collection of individuals. So when you think about how he's presented Franz, and the hope is that he's going to reemerge as a new man in this positive, a progressive humanist sense, working with and for others. But that can also be incorporated into a nationalistic version of it. You dedicate yourself to that national community. You dedicate yourself to the common good of a national socialism. And that's, you know, for all intents and purposes, what is going to happen. So Döblin's calling for an idealized socialism and perhaps underestimating the possibility that people are going to look for the same thing but find it in a national socialism. But obviously he's looking at the socialism that existed or had been in power up till 1929 as problematic. So this is the problem for the left. The problem for the left is we had a chance here, right? But we split among ourselves, the Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht break. We sold out for order to a certain degree with Ebert's deal with Gröne and the military, right, in order to get those soldiers in, right, and established an interim government that allowed for corruption. And as a result, the socialist experiment sputtered. So Döblin's looking at that and saying, we've got to move to a higher level of socialism. And that's his hope, I think. And that's what Franz is meant to symbolize. So, you know, moving to the last pages, he recovers, this new man recovers. Reinhold is arrested and tried, but I'll move to the very last pages. 632, so the last four pages. Now at last he is assistant doorman in a medium-sized factory. Okay, so he's got a job in a factory. I don't know if we find out how he got that job. After the trial, Bibikov is offered a job, so he gets it. There could be a problem right there with Döblin's political assessment. In 1929, things were tanking. Unemployment was going to get worse, not better. He is no longer alone on Alexanderplatz, so he's no longer alone. There are people to the right and people to the left of him. Some walk in front of him, others behind him. Much unhappiness comes from walking alone. When there are several, it's somewhat different. I must get the habit of listening to others, for what the others say concerns me too. Then I learn who I am and what I can undertake. So this is this larger sense of solidarity, this larger sense of sort of brotherhood that Döblin is, I think, symbolizing. From others, I learn who I am and what I can undertake. Everywhere about me, my battle is being fought, and I must be beware before I know that I'm in the thick of it. He is this assistant doorman in a factory. What is fate anyway? One is stronger than I. If there are two of us, it grows harder to be stronger than I. If there are 10 of us, it's harder still. And if there are 1,000 of us and 1,000,000, then it's very hard indeed. But it is also nicer and better to be with others. Then I feel and I know everything twice as well. A ship cannot lie in safety without a big anchor, and a man cannot exist without many other men. So here's that, I think, to a certain extent, idealistic vision that Döblin is prescribing for German society as a whole. If you just put it in straightforward political terms, he's criticizing a free market economy. That didn't work. That was the individual. That was Franz trying to fight, and it didn't work. So we need to have something that's more socialized, but socialized in a spiritual as well as a practical sense. Last page. Keep awake, eyes front, attention, 1,000 belong together, and he who won't watch out is fit to flay and flout. The drums roll behind him, marching, marching. We tramp to war with iron tread, 100 minstrels march ahead. Bibikov is a humble workman. We know what we know. The price we paid was not low. So this whole story is a story of edification toward the creation of this new guy. He's a humble workman, he accepts that, and he links up with other people. The way leads to freedom. To freedom it goes. The old world must crumble. Awake, wind of dawn, and get in step, and right and left, marching, marching on, we tramp to war. 100 minstrels march before with fife and drum, brum, brum. For one the roads go straight, for another goes to the side. One stands fast, another's killed. One rushes past, another voice is stilled. Drum, brum, brum. So the struggle is going to continue. But the argument here is there is progress that leads to freedom. To freedom it goes. The old world must crumble. Okay. Now we don't have to sit here and say, what exactly did Döblin mean? I've given you the best shot I have, and it's definitely fuzzy. Okay? And if I haven't made it any clearer, I apologize for that, but I don't think it is that much clearer. But see, what you have to realize is it's emblematic of just how complex the German situation was as the Weimar Republic was failing. Okay? He's got this nebulous vision of what could be better. But remember, you're looking at what was ostensibly a very liberal, progressive system. It's undermined by the fate of post-war politics and, of course, the economy. Okay? It's eaten away from within by corruption and divisions the left, but also attacks from the right. It was never really staunchly defended, even by people like Döblin. They did not defend the republic. The idea of the republic was distasteful even to the leftists who were in charge of it. They never wholly got behind it. Nobody really believed in that democracy. They either were looking for a more socialist version of it or a more authoritarian version of it. So this is why historians refer to the Weimar Republic as certain, to a certain extent, having been stillborn. It was there, but it didn't have anybody who would nurture it and defend it. Because even someone like Döblin is looking for something different, something nebulous, something beyond that as it passes away. The assumption that something's going to get better. We're going to get something better than the practical drudgery of negotiation in the democracy with all of its faults and with all of its inconsistencies and so on. Something better than the talk shop of parliamentary government. So even someone like Döblin, who should have been standing up and saying, damn it, we need this, we need to protect this, we need to fight for it, we shouldn't let it be undermined, didn't, in the hopes of something better. Right? And but there was no way, really, for him to foresee what would come. Right? That the Franzes of the world would march together, and they would go left, right, and they would go left, right, and they would line up in ranks and so on, looking for order to be found in a community of fellows who were dedicated not to some sort of idealized socialist version, but of a national version, a national socialism. So that's what we'll turn to, and to a certain extent it just folds right into that. Sorry, Döblin, that's not what they turned to. Many of your themes was right. We need to have order, we need to have solidarity, we need to have structure, we need to march together. A lot of people felt that way. But they'll find it on the right rather than on the left.